What's up, peeps? Before you get into the episode, just a quick message. Did you know that Rebranded Safety is brought to you by RiskFluent? Rebranded Safety is essentially our campaign to achieve our purpose, which is to make the working world better by rebranding safety one interaction at a time. We value a people-centered approach that delivers positive impact on the risk. We deliver three types of services: technical, transformational, and fire. It's the last two I want to talk to you about. If you value what we value and you want some support driving a culture change or decluttering your safety systems, or you want to improve human performance, then it's our transformational support that can help you. Or maybe you want a highly experienced registered fire risk assessor to carry out an assessment on your building, design an emergency plan, or review the fire safety design for your new building, then it's our fire support service that can help you. But before you get in touch with us, it's important that you want to have impact on the actual risk and you value a people-centered approach. If you don't, that's fine. You'll find someone that can help you. But if you do value those, then get in touch with us at riskfluentltd.com or email me, james@riskfluentltd.com. But for now, I'll let you get into the episode.
This show is brought to you by Safety FM.
What's up, peeps? Welcome back to Rebranded Safety. We are back to our normally scheduled content this week. I hope you enjoyed the first episode of the Diversity mini-series last week. And the first Monday of the month will be the next episode of the Diversity mini-series. And that's running all the way up until next year. So it's going to be loads of content, some really eye-opening conversations. So I hope you're enjoying it. But today, back to our normal scheduled content. Let's jump into the intro and I'll tell you some more about it.
The problem in safety isn't deviation, it's complexity.
Health and safety has gone mad.
Health and safety is trying to unpick having gone mad in the past.
There's no one solution and one problem. The problem is that we are looking for one solution.
Does the structure of the team allow them to flourish?
Feel safe enough to be uncomfortable.
The environment defines our behaviors.
People aren't the problem, they're the solution.
Rebranding Safety, crushing the stereotype. Brought to you by RiskFluent.
What's up, peeps? Welcome back to Rebranding Safety. Rebranding Safety is a YouTube channel and podcast doing exactly what it says on the channel. We're here to change the perception of safety. So if you're new here, hit that subscribe button and the bell and all those algorithm magical button thingamajigs. So today we are talking to the amazing, the absolutely phenomenal Ruth Denyer. And we actually spoke to Ruth a hell of a long time ago. This episode is really old. You all know where Ruth works now. She works at Netflix now. At the time of recording this, she was in the transition and we couldn't really say. So it was really difficult for us to have this conversation. But we talk about so much. Ruth is actually now my mentor. And I'm very, very lucky to get some time with Ruth once every now and then, whenever she could fit it in between calls with LA and God knows where else and that amazing job that she's got. I'm not going to get into my points on it. I hope you enjoyed the conversation. There'll be a reflection episode in a couple of days after this episode. Let's get into the conversation with Ruth. I'm going to go straight into it. So yeah. Ruth, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Very long time coming. We met in February and this has been, we've been trying to get you on to now and it's nearly February again.
Through the pandemic?
Yeah.
March. Yeah. Boom.
Yes, I don't think you could blame the pandemic on this.
No. I think we could blame life.
Yeah, life in general with a pandemic on top. But anyway, people that don't know you, why don't you give us a bit of an introduction into you and then we're just going to chinwag for a bit.
I am Ruth Denyer. I have been working in safety for 23 years now, quite a long time. I did a degree in health and safety. And then I went to work. My first ever safety job was at the National Theatre, which kind of says a lot about me, that I love trying to apply in the creative industries. I wanted to do something a bit different. And I've been at ITV for the last 16 years, which I have just left. And my last role there was group risk director. So I've taken kind of the safety piece and applied kind of that thinking around other risks. We've looked at resilience. We've looked at frameworks, done a bit around enterprise risk, but I know my passion is within the operation side. And now I am moving on to, which I start at the end of November, Netflix, to be their director of studio safety across the global footprint of Netflix, looking at kind of how we take safety forward and how we keep on doing the great things that they're already doing in the safety space around all their content making, content production activities globally. So I am looking forward to that. Bit of a change though after 16 years.
That's going to 16 years, Jesus. Yeah, I didn't even think of that. That's massive, actually, isn't it?
It's huge. And a couple of the people in my team at ITV, I have actually, well, a few of them I've worked with for that full 16-year period. So leaving a team that is so established and we work so closely together that you have like shorthand with each other. Mm. It's quite a big step. But
that's awesome.
You have to do it sometimes, don't you? And this is the job to do it for.
That must have been a bit more of an emotional decision as well. Like, it must have been really hard emotionally to leave somewhere after 16 years. That's like leaving a family.
It really is. And do you know what's interesting is I've had a few moments of clarity in my career, not many of them, to be honest, but a few of them. And one of them, I was thinking about what I wanted to do for the next, I'm in my mid 40s now. And you suddenly go, oh my God, I'm halfway through. And you go, what do I want to do for the next half of my way? And actually what I realized was the bit I'm so passionate about is the safety space. And because I'd become so broad where I was, so I was doing all group risk stuff and frameworks and a lot, which really interests me, and you all know from me that I'm really interested in kind of taking safety forward, looking at safety differently, or new, whatever you want to call it, is looking at it differently. otherwise I'll get trolled. And I wanted to do that in an organization that had a culture that supported the things that I really want to do just within the safety space and had the scale to be able to do that. So I thought when this role came up at Netflix, I thought, do you know what, if I'm going to leave for one role, this is going to be the role I'm going to leave for. And the culture at Netflix has fascinated me for years. Their culture deck, this context, not control, freedom and responsibility, all those messaging that are within its DNA, making safety work there seems like it should be really a great journey. And the team who are already there are brilliant. So I get some really good people to work with already.
Amazing. How was that? Like, that's interesting that you took that kind of broader risk term and then you've gone, actually what I want to focus on is the safety thing, whereas I don't know, I feel like I'm in this like focused safety role and I kind of think, do you know what, it needs to be risk, which is interesting. You've had that and gone, actually no, it needs to be back down into that, which is really interesting, because I'd have thought maybe you'd have gone, oh, do I really just want to go just into safety right now? Whereas
I was talking to someone who works at ITV now, and they were talking about you were either a GCSE, an A-level or degree person in your job. So either you are very specialist in one area, like a degree person, and you become very, and you really, or you become very broad and you're like a GCSE person doing lots of different things and overseeing a lot, but not one thing specially. And you want to do what you want to do, quite frankly. I think I apply safety and make safety work in a very different way because I understand it within a risk context and I talk about it within a risk context. And maybe that's where I kind of go, actually, this is where we can take it forwards now, is if we take that, all my learning that I've taken, do it looking at risk more broadly, and then go back and go, okay, let's really do safety in this space where we're talking about it as a risk that we manage and how do we do that? Then that's where we can really have an impact. And I still think there's a load of impact safety can have that we haven't quite nailed. We talk about the theories a lot. Everybody's talking about what we can do and how we can do things in a different way. But actually the doing, the applied part of it, it's not all there yet. There's a lot of people trying to apply different bits. So I feel like we haven't finished this chapter yet. We need to finish this chapter before we move on to the next one. And I feel like I got to the end of the book and then went, hang on a minute, I didn't really read chapter one properly.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I think a lot of the time we're arguing just about words, but I think there is something in that, like you said, you talk about it in a risk context. Like, I talk to a lot of customers about, like, do you have a different, just using this very kind of physical example, like risk assessments, is your risk assessment in safety different from your risk assessment in finance and investment and marketing, for example? Well, we don't have a risk assessment in finance and marketing. Yeah, you do. You just don't know you have one.
I think so. we did one of my most interesting courses that we've developed, sessions that we've run, whatever you want to call it. So we did this whole piece around leading risk, which comes from safety, but we wanted to talk about safety as one of the things you manage and you lead the decisions on if you're in a leadership role within the organization. And we talked about, I spent a lot of time talking to Emma Sohn at LSE about this and how you don't give a conforming answer. So with safety, when people say, is it okay to hurl or injure people? The answer is no. The conforming answer is no, we don't. And if you, but what you have to do is change the conversation slightly. So you're talking about what you are trying to achieve and what you'll risk to achieve it, because you get a much richer conversation. Mm-hmm. And that's what people think about in the finance world. And that's what they think about maybe around marketing, is they think, but what are we going to gain? What are we going to get out of this risk that we're taking? Mm-hmm. So we did a whole piece where we talked about what success looks like first. So what is it you're striving to get? What is it you want to achieve? And what are you willing to risk to get it? And we did this piece, and I was on this course at LSE, and I suddenly thought it was about, Emma talks a lot about psychology. And I was thinking about the psychology of taking risks and how when we talk about it, in a, you've got a 5x5 matrix and you're talking about a ladder normally and people falling off a ladder, and it doesn't really land with leadership teams. And I was thinking about, okay, so if we talk about what success looks like and we get you to really focus on what you're trying to achieve, be it whatever, a BAFTA, millions of viewers, critical acclaim, whatever it is. And then on the floor, we put cards down that were like your risk impact. So would you be happy with having a paper cut, or would you be happy killing or injuring many people, or the mental health impact on many people? Pick up the card you're willing to risk to get this outcome. Mm. And the conversation was amazing and is amazing. And we did the same with money, and we did the same with reputational impact. But it just, it's the same conversation we have and we think we're having, but as you have it a different way, the buy-in and the richness of the learning from that, phenomenally different. It's called the cards on the floor exercise now at ITV. Mm. And the team do it a lot in training, because you actually start to then talk about, and you put it in a risk context. You don't put it in a, this is what we're telling you is the wrong thing to do. We're saying, okay, what are you willing to do? And then having the conversation about, do you really think that's okay? And when you say you're only willing to have a paper cut, but actually what are you doing? And is that really reflective in the decisions you make and the risks people take?
Yeah. That, Ruth, that exact example there, that's the first thing I ever remember you talking about. And it wasn't in February when we met. It was before then. I can't remember what it was. I went into some webinar and you were talking about that. And not to, you know, kind of blow smoke up you, but it was like, that blew my mind. When you said that, I was like, what an amazing exercise that must have been.
Do you know what? It works. It's just, and I genuinely think it's what makes our jobs so interesting. And maybe that's what made me go, but we haven't finished this yet. We can do, I think safety is actually quite far developed in the kind of, in all the risk domains. Safety has actually got a lot of learning behind it. If you look at the other people who are trying to manage risk in organizations, so you look at data risk and personal data and how people are trying to manage that now, that's a relatively new space people are going into. We've got years and years of learning and going down paths that we go, maybe that doesn't work here, trying different things, writing procedures in offices that we put on shelves that nobody ever follows. I've done that. I've written a lovely procedure that I knew nobody was going to follow, but I thought we needed a procedure. So you kind of go, actually, we've got loads of learning. We need to take this and be proud of it and be the leaders, I guess, finish the story around safety so we can actually show how we make it work in different ways in different places, and then take the other people with us, the other risk domains.
Yeah, I think that's fascinating. You said it. I can't remember if I did a podcast on it or not, or whether I thought of doing it, but I had this idea. I've done so many now, I've lost track of what I've done. But it's, I had this thought, I remember having this thought process around exactly what you've just said, that data security from, it was around the GDPR time a few years ago when that came in, and there was this big drive around it. And I remember being in an office and this lady walked through who was like the data security marshal. And she come through and she's like, literally, James. I'm like, hiya. Yeah. Have you got your lanyard on? Yeah. Why? And she's like, good. Thank you. Clipboard, ticked it off. Ruth, have you got your lanyard on? Yeah. Cool. Thank you. And you could tell she was like, five people asked. And I sat there and I went, data security is making the exact same failings that we made a few years ago. I wonder if they would listen to us and maybe learn from our mistakes.
And I think, and this is where I think actually as a professional, maybe this is part of me wanting to dive back into doing safety, is we're not very good at saying what we're good at and saying what we've learned. And I think people tend to, I genuinely think actually the COVID place, if you've been allowed to grab hold of it as a risk and safety team and actually really support the business in managing it, it's been a moment where people have gone, God, it's really valuable what you guys do.
This is what you do.
This is what you spend your days doing. But I think there's loads of other risks. And if you look at things like mandatory training, you know, what have we learned in safety around training people and how you land messages and you know, how useful talks on the, those toolbox talks or conversations on the ground, pre-start chats, all that stuff. And then you've got other people doing mandatory training that maybe goes down the route we would have done when we had to do it as a compliance-based training piece and we would have thought about it 15 years ago, whereas now we're kind of moving on. And I just think it's really interesting to try and capture that and also influence people outside of our world to go, actually, do you know what? We've learned so much.
That is so true. And I think that training piece is interesting. Now you say that, it's got my brain going, but it's like there's a great piece of research that HSE did around manual handling training. I don't know if you ever saw it, but it basically, the long and short of it is it kind of says manual handling training in its traditional sense is not as effective as what you think it is. You're much better off focusing on, you know, the occupational health side, trying to incentivize better fitness, better strength. So giving people, you know, discounts on gym memberships or having a gym at your workplace and things like that. Obviously, some of this stuff is completely out of the financial scope of some businesses, but it was just trying to say you can't just rely on just manual handling training. And then it made me think about how I've kind of looked at manual handling training. And I remember going into a job and they had this manual handling training package that they delivered in. And the first four slides of like this 70 slide pack was all on the manual handling regs. And then the next four slides were all on the Health and Safety at Work Act. And then the next four were all on the management of safety, management of health and safety at work regulations. And I literally was sitting there and I'm like, I remember saying to my boss, can I change these? And she was like, yeah, it's all yours. Right. Control, all, delete.
Like, do you know, it's the best thing you can do is because it's one of the things we've said a lot. We don't cover any law in any of the training now that the team deliver at ITV because people aren't driven by the law.
No,
that's not what drives you. I mean, the nerds of us who actually quite enjoy knowing how it all fits together and what the legal requirements are. Yes, fine. We should know that and we need to know that. But actually, the reason you don't want people to get hurt isn't because the law says it. It's because you don't want people to get hurt. And it's the story.
Exactly. And it's kind of like that. So what's that subconscious thing that it says to an employee as well? Like, hi, Ruth, you must go on this training because it's compliant. For us to be compliant, or you must do this risk assessment for us to be compliant. What they're saying is not wrong. Like, that is one of the drivers for a company to do this stuff. I don't deny that. We need to do it. And for a company, you look at your risks and you go, you know, litigation is a risk. So we want to manage that. How can we manage that? Deliver some training. Okay, boom. There is an element of tick boxing we can't get away from. But when you say to me as an employee, I think, Ruth, you must go on this training to be compliant. That tells me you don't really care about me, I think.
No, and I think. The thing about tick boxing is that a lot of the tick boxing stuff we do and we think we need to do is because it's how it's been done over time and in other places. Actually, it takes quite a lot to step back and go, to what end are we doing this? Do we really need to do this? Does the law really say we need to do this? Or is this how it's been built up over the last 10, 15 years that we should do this? And we're just doing what the other organizations are doing. And we're just assuming that's the right way of doing it. Actually going, hang on, what do we have to do liability wise? What do we want to do for our people? What are we trying to achieve? And actually having a look at it through that lens and not just because other people have done it. We've gone down routes with even what's the purpose of a risk assessment? Why do we record a risk assessment? We record a risk assessment because we legally need to record the significant findings. Then you go, what does record mean? And you can have really long discussions, or you can train people to fill out a form in a certain way because that's the way the form's always been filled out.
Yeah.
And so I think part of it on us, and certainly looking to a more global organisation, and also ITV operates globally, is actually what are our expectations globally of what we need to do, what we do to look after our people and the people impacted by what we do. Because the law at a global level is complex and it's going to be challenging to navigate, but actually you need to get back to your core principles, which are what we're trying to do.
Mm.
And why do we do all this stuff, actually? Mm. Why are we here? We're not here just to get people to tick boxes and click through slide decks.
Yeah, we're here to enable, like, I quite like the way that I've just interviewed Dominic Cooper, and we spoke about this before, but I quite like the way he talks about it. Like, it, we're trying to have a safe production. It's not safety or production, it's safe production. So we're still trying to do the job. Like,
I also think we as a profession are trying to, yes, support it in being safe, but support people in understanding the risks they're taking.
Mm.
Because I think otherwise it becomes someone else's issue to make it safe. Actually, yeah, if you are doing something, you are responsible for all the risks associated with that. You take the credit, you also take the risks. And maybe our part of the role that's got missed off a bit is the bit that says, actually, these are the risks you're taking. Are you happy to accept them? Because everything won't always be completely 100%. Nobody ever gets hurt in any way, shape or form. Because that's not the way the world works. And that's not the way businesses work either. And it's about where you're willing to take that to.
I love that. When you did that wrist on the tiles, cards on the floor thing, like, was it interesting what cards people were picking up? Were people picking up lower risk cards than what actually happens? Like, because I imagine in the ITV world, like, and I don't know, but I imagine in that kind of space, like the news team having to go into war state or war torn, you know, towns and whatever, like, I imagine fatality is quite a likely thing in some of these scenarios, but I can't imagine a director saying, I accept that. So that must have been a real challenge.
And so that's part of the conversation. Actually, there is so much amazing planning that goes in when you deploy news reporters, and ITV doesn't do lots of breaking news. ITN does, but obviously get involved and we talk about it.
Yeah.
That yes, there is still a residual risk that you talk about and you understand. And I actually think people really grasp that, because it's very, you can feel it, can't you? If you're going into, you know, they're going into a war zone, there'll be live fire, there'll be stuff. And there's a load of planning. The risk assessments are all signed off by the people who own that risk. So the producers, they're talked about, they're briefed. There's loads and loads of work that goes on. I think what's interesting is actually the conversations people have with each other. So the conversations people say, oh, well, in my content, I'd be happy with this. And someone else is feeling further down the scale. And actually I found really interesting was having the people conversation. So the physical safety risk versus the financial risk conversations and how risk averse some people are financially.
Oh, wow.
And then you go, so you're not willing to risk money, but you will risk this. And like, oh, yeah, actually. And you just have those richer conversations and actually the reputational impact conversations, because I think a lot of what businesses try and do now is manage reputational impact of risks, be they financial. If you look at all the stuff that goes on outside of just safety, all the stuff, the big stories about businesses, a lot in the sustainability space, a lot of it is about managing business. Yes, it's the right thing to do, but it's managing the impact and the reputation of the business. And so how people feel about the risks they're taking reputationally as well. And if that's okay or not okay. And do you want stories in the media? Do you not want stories in the media? And how dependent on the organization you work for, that will be a much bigger driver, because some companies, the media will write about whatever happens.
Yeah.
So I think it's about not having an answer, but having a conversation and people actually having the proper conversation rather than thinking, I've got a safety person in, they've filled out a risk assessment, it's now safe.
Yeah.
And that's what I never, ever want to be.
Yeah. That's like a daily struggle, I think, for most safety professionals, that we're not here to do safety. Like I think I actually wrote in that IOS ring that we were talking about, I think it was in there, but we talk about it a lot on Future Leaders. Like, we need to get this message across that we're not experts, we're facilitators.
Yeah. Can't also be experts in all the technical specialisms under safety. And I think that's part of, as a safety professional, it's quite hard, because you come in with a qualification, whatever it is, or maybe you don't have the qualification yet and you come in, and people will come to the safety team about anything and everything. And if you work in a production making community, that anything and everything can genuinely be anything and everything. From, we're talking about it, because when I was leaving ITV, we were talking about the most amazing moments we've had there. And like, from the, can I put my head in a box of bees? Let's ask the safety team. Through to, can I use this cage to dive with a shark because it's made out of perspex? Yeah. Is it okay? And you go, that's actually not my specialism, but I will help you find the people whose it is. Or I will
ring the box of bees team.
But you do. And some of them, you just go, but actually what you're doing is you're helping navigate to the answer that actually, and what you're doing is you're helping them understand what the risk is and how they can manage it. And then what the risk left over is. But being able to say, I don't necessarily know that answer, is quite difficult to begin with, because you kind of think you should. And the amount of times you're talking about, I didn't do a module on that in my degree. Because you're like, how would I know the answer to that question? And yeah. I've loved doing that because I love the craziness of it all. Because you then go, well, I'm sure there's an answer out there somewhere. Thank God for Google is all I can say.
Tell me about it. Yeah. Tell me about it. It's funny when you give those examples, I'm like, part of me is like, oh, there's some crazy examples you thought of. But then I remind myself that you work at ITV. So I'm like, actually, I think these are real conversations. Box of bees, cage of sharks, etc.
Just even stuff. Things like, I remember when they first started using dry ice in cooking, you know, they started using it to make ice cream. It was Heston Blumenthal's thing. And I was at ITV all those years ago when it was a new thing. Like, okay, how do we use dry ice safely for cooking? You're like, oh my God, okay, let's go for it. But you hadn't planned it because you hadn't worked that out yet. And you just, you get to understand the risks, put in place the mitigations of the business and explain them as well, talk about them.
Yeah. Was it an evolution an evolution that ITV went through as well? Like, were they, when you started there, like you say, you've been there a hell of a long time. You just kind of seen them evolve in the way they looked at safety? Well, when you got there, was it different?
When I got there, it was very different. We were joking, actually. So when I started, it was just a merged company. It merged Granada and Carlton. So you had this kind of, anyone who's worked in a company that's merged, you have kind of different views and people coming together and it's quite sticky.
Challenging.
Yes. And I started as the health and safety manager for London. So I had two other people working with me and we were literally in a cupboard. Like it was a proper old fashioned safety cupboard. You kind of walked down the back route and all the way.
Cupboard.
It was on the way to this morning studio. So we got to see people coming past, but we were literally in a cupboard. Cool. And I think the last 16 years have literally been getting out on the floor, getting talking to people, understanding what they're trying to achieve, not being seen as the police force, actually reading through the 146 different procedures that we inherited and going, I don't even understand what this says. I don't know how anyone does. Or I think you photocopied this one from another organization because it doesn't actually make sense because those jobs don't exist here. But all those things you start to reframe it and you start to rethink about it. You redo the training, you buy people in. And then in the past 6 or 7 years, the studios business, so the big content making part of ITV has grown hugely and acquired a lot of companies, become a much bigger umbrella under which there are 55 different like indie production companies operating globally. Wow. And so you have a different model of how do we keep an oversight of those risks, but we can't be on the floor all the time. We're not, and kind of where safety space is in that and what line of defense you're in, which we've talked about a lot in terms of kind of the risk management system. But it's been, yes, it evolves. And I think it just helps if you have people who are really passionate about it in the middle, taking people with you. So doing that training, explaining to people, getting people engaged genuinely, I think, because people see, like, we've been part of it and they're by the side of them and really invested in all the stuff we've been doing personally because it matters. And I think people really have felt that and seen it.
Yeah. Which part of
so
that,
yes, like... it's been a journey. It's the short answer.
Which part of that kind of like was, I'm just talking from my own experience, like I found probably like maybe over half of the battle is when you're getting on the shop floor is dealing with that perception that I'm not here to stop you, like I'm actually here to help you. And like, you know, like the jet, like the, I can see it when I'm talking to people that are in operational roles where they stumble over their words because they realize they're talking to the safety guy where they're like, oh, it could be anything, like, oh, we're trying to get this done, obviously we're trying to get it done as safe as possible. And I'm like, you don't need to say that just because I'm here. Like, I want to know, you don't have to put safe in every single other sentence, you know, just to make sure that you satisfy me.
You know, I think it is a challenge. I think the other thing has been, and a big focus for us has been moving the conversations around safety upstream. So actually, when you're having an idea or a thought or you're planning something, come and talk to us and we'll help you do it. And we'll help, because by the time it's reality and you're in production, if you like, it's much harder to plan in safety, because actually you plan it in really early on and the concepts allow you to plan. And I think because we've approached it like that, we've become part of the people who they go to, who go, we're thinking of doing this, what do you reckon? Any ideas, any thoughts, any? And you become a colleague who has a different impact because you're part of this, hopefully, this planning. And to be honest, you're there if it doesn't go to plan, and you're there supporting people and helping them and helping navigate what you need to do. And I think, you know, that bit about being in it with everybody, it's really, really important. So you learn what it's like, because it's hard. Making these things happen. And I don't think I appreciated it. I wouldn't appreciate it fully unless I'd seen what it takes to make these things happen. Hours and hours of programming that comes out on TVs or internet delivered TV. Yeah. It's phenomenal what it takes to make these things come to life.
Yeah.
And you want to be part of that, because that's why I want to be working in that sector, because it's brilliant, because you spend your time trying to solve problems and make things happen.
Yeah, cool. Do you think I had a great question then, and I was so into what you were saying then, I completely forgot it. What was I going to say? Oh, it's gone. What? Oh,
was it about a box of bees? I would
probably. I mean, the box of bees thing is still in there. Like, how would I deal with that? Box of bees. Can I put my head in a box of bees? What is the risk? How do I put that into a 5x5 box?
Or do you have a conversation? And also, what mitigations do you put in place once you've decided you do want to put your head in a box of bees?
Yeah. I've got it. It's come back. It's come back to me. I was going to say, not that I really don't want to get into the space of safety one and safety two, but I genuinely think one of the things that I think that this safety new view, safety two space has raised, which I think is very, very good, is a one-liner I heard a while ago. I can't remember who it was from. Was, I think it might have been Ron Gant. It's this whole issue around blame. Now, you know that is like this, that's probably the big cause of all these arguments. And I don't think what Safety 2 World is saying, they don't blame. And again, I'm not going to get into this, but now I think you kind of touched on it without even mentioning new view, safety, blah, blah, blah. It's that when you're talking to people and engaging with them and you're saying, like you were saying, the aim here is to get the production done. Like, I'm here to try and work out how we can get it done. I'm with you on the front line, trying to work out how we can do it. To be in that position, you can't also be the person that's going to blame them when it goes wrong. Like, you have to be there with them when it goes wrong, in a way. Like, that's what I felt like you were kind of saying. So it's like we're talking safety too about even talking safety too, which brings me to my point, in that I call a lot of this stuff like safety as originally intended, like good safety, what we were supposed to do. Or do you feel like it's something that we picked up through that process of learning? Like, I feel like when I look at the ACOPS and stuff in the HSC, I feel like they're trying to tell us to do that anyway.
I think some of it is, well, it's also you can read things through a different lens, can't you? So once you start thinking in a certain way, you can interpret it in the way your mind naturally goes. I think it's not necessarily safety. It's just the way the world has moved. If you look at psychological safety, there isn't a safety discipline. It's looking at how you manage organizations and get the best out of them. Mm. And all the Amy Edmondson stuff. So blame is such a toxic thing within an organization, be it safety or anything else. That idea of blame and people then not speaking up, it's not just safety. It's everything. It's how you run a successful organization. And I think that's what really interests me about kind of the movements in safety, is a lot of them reflect wider movements. So not just a change in safety, a change in the way organizations are run. So if you look at stuff like constant feedback up and down the organization, that's probably not something 20, 25 years ago people would have had as much as on the front and thought was so important, that the very people who want the hierarchy shouldn't matter as much for feedback because everybody has really important information that you should galvanize to make an organization successful. So I think the way safety's going actually reflects a lot of the thinking around successful organizations, not just successful safety.
I love that.
Because actually, go on. No, that's because I love that stuff and I think it's really interesting.
All I was going to say is that right there is a soundbite. That bit you've just said is getting cut up and made into a little short video. 100%. That was beautiful. Well said. I think that's kind of what we need to hear more of.
It is. And if you look at, and that's where I, you know, and I talk briefly about why Netflix appeals, and which around the culture at Netflix. And if anyone hasn't seen it, it's worth looking at, because what it does as a culture is a lot of the stuff and the bits that safety, whether you call it new view or you call safety differently or whatever, you, where safety is moving is important. So the one of their key beliefs, context, not control, take that statement and apply it to safety. Mm. And you've got everything everybody's talking about at the moment. And if you take the freedom and responsibility, that's, to me, that's ownership of risk. That's you own them, you have responsibility for them, but you also have freedom to make decisions. But everybody needs to be engaged in that. So I think, you know, for me, it's the, it's one part of a whole.
Mm. Yeah, I love that. When you got, I've spoken about accountability so many times, and I actually got turned down from a job, right, because of my stance on accountability. The big thing, though, I'm not going to mention who they are.
tell me later.
Yeah, yeah. They basically, when I was looking for the job and I got approached for the job and blah, 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 it was the big thing they want to do, James, is they want to drive accountability down from the top. And I was like, okay, I've heard that hundreds of times, but what does that actually mean for them? Like, what are they trying to do? And anyway, it came up in the interview, second interview. And they were like, we want to drive accountability down from the top. And I was like, yeah, I've heard you want to do that. How do you think you should do that? And I went down the route that you've just kind of, which I love, that freedom and responsibility. I think that's that and there for me is the big thing. And I said to them, like, in this interview, similarly to what you've just said, like, you don't make someone accountable by telling them to be accountable. Like, hold yourself responsible. Like, what you do is you involve them in it, and they are part of making that decision. And a lot of the time, I think, you know, if you think back, we used to call it pride in our work. That's accountability. Mm-hmm. Taking pride in your work is accountability. Now, we would go, oh, we don't take pride in our work anymore. No, it's not like that. The decisions of that pride is taken away from us. Like, we've got scopes in our work that are so tight now. Like, you know, there's probably numerous listeners to this podcast probably had some massive FM company or something, and they've raised a job to come and fix a door, and they've just sent, because of their procedures, they've just sent a painter to come and fix a door, and that painter doesn't do it, and because he's a painter, he's not a joiner or a door repairman or whatever, and it's not his fault. He's the wrong person for the job, but the scope, the procedures, et cetera, are so rigid. They've eliminated pride for the work. But he's also got this goal conflict and that he needs to do something when he gets there. So he tries to fix that door as best as he can, right? And fails because he's a painter, not a joiner. And then we blame that person for doing a crappy job. And I just think, we're talking about accountability, but actually what we need to kind of talk about maybe is autonomy. And then once we get some autonomy, accountability will come. People choose to be accountable. They're not made to be accountable. That's how I kind of look at it. The guy said, I disagree with you, James, on that point. I think we need to make people accountable. And I was like, well, that's your prerogative to disagree with me. Surprise, surprise, about 24 hours later, I got an email saying, you have not been successful.
Do you know what? I think it's really interesting, isn't it? I think about all the joyous roles and responsibilities documents we've had to draft over time, because you do need to be clear what people's responsibilities are and what their roles are. Yeah. But in doing that, you need to really think about where it should sit and who should be responsible and what that means and how you articulate that. And I think a lot of what organizations feel more comfortable with is if you've got it really nailed down, and you know, but actually it doesn't matter what you've got nailed down. It matters what you've communicated to people and what people understand and what all the processes are that support that thought that you are, it is your world to make a decision and you are able to make a decision. You don't have to rigidly follow whatever it is if you feel it's wrong. Mm. And so that's where I go back to, actually safety is one thing within a whole organization that needs to be managed. And actually a lot of the things that we're looking at now are the things that organizationally need to change to make organizations more successful, because it's probably gone down a route that is too rigid in a lot of places. And I think that's probably one, I mean, I clearly love being in the sector I'm in. I love the space I'm in. I love the creativity, but I also love the fact that there is a real sense of there is a real sense of pride and ownership. People making content love making content. They've got such a passion for it. Up and down, wherever you go, people really care. And people really want it to be amazing and people to enjoy it or to learn or whatever it is. So I think that helps because it's an easy one to win, message to win, if people really care about what they do. The other terms we use a lot and we've started to use are ownership and oversight, because responsibility, accountability, you spend more time defining the term than having the conversation. And we looked at across this business that we have, where you have the ITV, where you kind of needed to know someone owns it, so they are accountable, if you like, or responsible, whichever, but at the same time you need to have a layer above that knows what's going on, the big stuff's flagged to, understands what risks are being taken every day. And we looked at where there's this line between ownership and oversight, and that was easier to explain to the business than responsibility, accountability, anything else, because actually it was because we talk about you own the risks. And it's kind of more normal language for people, isn't it?
Yeah, that is true. I remember using the phrase responsible person in a framework, and I spent more time explaining that, well, actually, in the eyes of the law, the real responsible person is the CEO, not you. Mm-hmm. This is just a term we're using to say you're responsible on a day-to-day basis to do your job. And when I think back on it, I think, the problem wasn't the process, because once I explained it, they got it. It was the word that we used that was scary. Yeah. Oh, I'm a responsible person. That's a legal term, isn't it? And that just, you know, got their back up. And I think exactly what you said there. I think sometimes we spend so much time explaining this stuff that we're just not even talking about what it actually is. And I think as well, like when you get the point of what you said there, like companies want this stuff nailed down. They want it written down, nailed down, so they can say that's where our confidence is. Like when you see something on the news, and, you know, I always kind of use a Grenfell example from when I was in housing. Like the aim for me was the aim is to obviously never have, if you work in housing, never have that fire again. But from an assurance point of view, a corporate point of view, the aim is that my CEO wakes up and turns the news on and there's a fire like that, and he knows, he's, you know, pretty confident that that's not his property, because he's got that level of assurance. The problem is when we get that assurance from just our paperwork, I feel, and that paperwork doesn't reflect reality 9 times out of 10, because we didn't have that flexibility to deal with the complex environment that is day-to-day work, it lures us into a false sense of security in a way.
Yeah, I think there's a massive issue with over-assurance and actually knowing what assurance is there for. So I spent a lot of time kind of looking at how we report stuff up within the organisation, and just kind of overall reporting on what's going on where and where the flags are and all that stuff. Actually, really, what you want to be reporting is you want to give information so people ask the right questions. That's really what your board reports are for, or your executive reports. So you give them enough information that go, hang on a minute, you know, am I worried about this? Am I not? Or what are we doing around here? That looks like there's a gap. Actually, what you don't want to be there to do, I don't feel this should be my role, is to say everything's okay all the time, everywhere. Because actually, I think that's where it's being driven to. It's all the green dashboards, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I heard a great term, and I can't remember who said it. And it was, I think it was one of the HC
Watermelon Network reporting. Conference.
I loved that. I thought that
I
was
knew you were going to say that.
Because I was like, that's exactly what, and actually, we are doing ourselves an injustice if we're not saying, helping the business, going, do you know what, I see all of this, these are the bits that I, and people say you should tell people what you stay awake at night worrying about, but then how many people actually put that into their reporting protocols and everything else? And how many people go to their safety team and go, do you know what, whatever numbers we've got in systems and stuff, what are you worried about, what do you feel uncomfortable about, and let's talk about that, because actually you guys know what to be worried about, or you know where it's good.
Yeah, I knew you were going to say that watermelon.
I loved that.
I remember sitting in that room, and I, to this day, cannot remember who said it either. I remember Stuart Hughes as well from the Vice President IOSH. He said the same, and that he loves it, and he says it all the time as well. And I'm sure, if I remember rightly, he can't remember who said it either. I feel like it never happened. It's kind of that the Mandela effect. You know what? Have you ever heard of that?
Do you know, it might have been. I know. It definitely did happen. It definitely did happen.
I'm not sure, you know. I'm not sure because I can't find anyone that everyone remembers that being said, but no one remembers who said
it. You know,
it.
Whoever was doing that presentation must be really annoyed because you'd want it to be coined as I remember where.
Yeah, yeah, totally. I'd be pissed if I'd said something like that and everyone's talking about it. And I'm like, that was me. And they're like, no, I don't think it was you. Oh, yeah, it was. Yeah, that was such a good one-liner. I've nicked it and used it every day. And every time I say it, there's somebody in the room or in the call that goes, that's really good. And I'm like, I know.
It's a good one, isn't it? Yeah. And actually, and it's the green that's red underneath. And it's so much of what compliance-driven reporting gives you.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. My an old boss of mine who I highly regard, he used to say, you know, we suffer from good news reporting. You know, we force ourselves to, you know, only hear good news. And sometimes I think that's a misconception. Like, I feel like sometimes you've got like the CEO, right? And then you've got the board, and or it may not be the board, it might be middle management, but somebody at some point seems to have this kind of like cohesive kind of collective understanding that the board don't want to hear bad news, or the CEO doesn't want to hear bad news, so we're like, well, okay, let's try and fix that before we go to them, or something like that. And I get the kind of, you know, don't just come to me with problems, come to me with solutions. I don't mean don't bring problems to me, I mean come to me with a problem and an idea, and then we'll see if we can elaborate on that. That's what I mean. But I think a lot of the time I sit there and I think, you know what, if I rang the CEO and said, what do we do about this? I reckon they'd just turn around and go, I didn't even know we had that. Here's a checkbook, get it sorted.
And I think, or there's the bit that is actually what we organizations take risks every day to achieve their objectives, be they risks, whatever. Actually, I think we aren't doing what we need to be doing is reflecting the risks that are being taken in pursuit of whatever goals they are. And actually, we haven't really thought about it like that. We've thought we're in the place where we report on what is being controlled rather than what risks are being taken. So then flip it on its head and say, how do I explain what risks are being taken in pursuit of our goals and our objectives? It's a very different report.
I'm going to write report. That down. That was good.
It's got a notebook out as well. I think it's really interesting when you start to challenge yourself to say, how do I tell someone? How do I explain within kind of a context that they'll get quickly, because you need to be to the point very fast, what risks are being taken in pursuit of our organizational goals and what risks with people were being taken, rather than just saying it's all okay or I know the solution, because often we don't know the solution and often what we're doing carries risk.
Oh, I love that. I'm full-on writing that down in pursuit of our goals. I'm like, that is spot on, because I find that a lot of the times it's not what we're saying, it's how we say it. Like I think I keep coming back to the safety two stuff, but one of the things that I think Eric says, and I understand his point, he talks about efficiency and thoroughness trade-off, the safety sits in the thoroughness side, and I think I'm not saying he's wrong, like I agree and understand what he's saying. The problem is what I think that communicates to the layman, the operations directors, the CEOs, they want efficiency. They really want efficiency, because the lack of efficiency costs them money. So I'm like, and I'll put this to Todd Conklin. He asked me my definition of safety, and I said, I think safety is efficiency. And that was it. He didn't let me finish. He destroyed me, throws loads of papers at me that tell me why I'm wrong, etc. And it was good fun. It was a good laugh, but I still stand by it, because I think efficiency is a word that people understand. And I think for me, what efficiency is I look at efficiency from a more holistic point of view, maybe, and maybe my definition of efficiency is different, but I think it's inefficient to have an accident. From a business perspective, it's inefficient for us to have lost time, for us to damage property, for us to not maintain our car, for example, stuff like that.
See, I think the conversation, and hats off to all the very intelligent academics who work in this space, because I'm not an academic, I'm an applied person. Mm-hmm. But I would say it's, you know, I talked about bringing safety upstream. So yeah, the further upstream safety gets, the less impact it has on operational delivery. And sometimes it makes operational delivery more effective because actually you can plan it in. So you plan the activity in a way that actually is more effective than you thought before you involved the safety people, because they've got some great ideas about how to deliver quickly, effectively, on time, and also plan in safety. And that brings, I suppose, putting the thoroughness for safety upstream then makes you more efficient downstream, because yeah, as you're exactly doing it, it becomes more efficient. So I think part of it is, and I absolutely, the relationship between thoroughness and efficiency when you're doing an, when you're actually on the sharp end delivering an activity, often doing the safety protocols and parts of it take time and effort, and that costs money, and therefore it does impact efficiency on delivery of that task, individual task. And actually you can probably do it many, 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 many times and not end up with the lost time incident or anything like that. So maybe actually, you know, if you look at it in that tiny space of work at the moment it's being done. But I think it plays out into a much broader conversation when you don't just talk about the moments that work are done, you talk about the planning that goes into that work and all the activity that comes beforehand. Because if you do that well, and that in a way that involves the right people at the right time and plans it well, then the work becomes, to your, use your word, the efficient word, or another word that I could think of, which I can't think of at the moment, that wouldn't get me into trouble with all these great thinkers.
But I think that is the big challenge we've got here with all that stuff. It's I think it's Adam Johns that said this to me, but like, words create worlds. And then when me and Todd were, for lack of a better word, debating or arguing about this efficiency word, Todd nailed it in one way. He said, you know, this is a great example of how words really only exist in our own heads. We've all got different explanations of each individual words.
And we get all stuck in on this, and you go, actually, if you go to global organizations, we have to have words that work across borders, across the world, in different spaces. So actually, we need to think more about what we mean by our words than what the words themselves are. So actually explaining the context for the word, if you like, is actually more important than the word we hang that context off, because you might use a different word. There may not be a word in a culture that is the same word that we would use, and you may Google translate it and it comes off as something completely different. So actually the context for the word is so much more important than the word we hang it off.
That is a great example, that kind of lost in translation stuff. There's a documentary actually on Netflix where they it's about a cycling team. I can't remember the movie Cycling Team, and they followed Zerm and all that stuff. And I was listening to a podcast where they were talking about it, and they said, "Oh, there's some stuff that he said, I'm being pedantic, but there's some stuff that annoyed me a little bit, like the translation is a bit off." And I was like, "Where's he going with this?" And he said, "You know, they called it a scoreboard when they translated from, I think this." Colombian, some of them, and when they translated it to English, it's a scoreboard, but in cycling it's not a scoreboard, it's a leaderboard. And I was just like, that's such a simple thing, but actually if you were talking about something quite in my world and our world from a safety point of view, that could be something huge. That's completely different. Scoreboard and leaderboard are two completely different things.
Yeah.
And if we were talking in a safety context, that's huge.
And that's it. So we get tied up on semantics and words, and I get that the discussions around what they mean are very interesting, but actually they're much more interesting than the word itself.
Yeah, definitely. Like, I don't know how many hours I've lost in my life in phone calls where somebody's gone, yeah, but how do we define safety? And then I'm like, oh, do we have to talk about this? And then 10 minutes later I'm full on in that debate. And like, I can't back away from it. And then like 4 hours later, I'm still there and we're still arguing about it. And they're good conversations. Don't get me wrong. They are. I love them. But you're right in that I just think, do you know what? The people I'm trying to help really don't give a crap on how we define safety, because we've just proved in this conversation that if I asked them to define safety, it would be completely different to how I would as well.
And actually, it might be different in different cultures, because it will be, because it will mean different things in different cultures. I really, you know, I'm all for the safety is the presence of capacity piece, because I think it's really important that we get to a point where safety is seen as a positive. not just stopping a negative. And I, do you know what, however we decide to articulate that, I think it's a really important part of how we actually attract people to do this as a profession. Yeah, that it's not seen as a negative piece that you just have to do to tick boxes.
It's funny though, isn't it? Like, if you think of the word safe, that's a very positive word, really, isn't it? Like, if you just say, you say to your kids, like, oh, we're nice and safe and sound. You know, I feel nice and safe at home. I can relax on them at home because I'm nice and safe. You know, the doors are locked. You know, people strive to be safe in their normal day life, like daily lives. But the second we get into work, safety is this thing that's a bane of our lives. Like, when did that happen? Like, what, where did we go wrong?
Completely. And actually, that's the bit, did safety go mad? Well, something went mad for it to be. And I was talking to Anna Keane, and we were just talking about purpose professions. I love that term, because this is a purpose. It's about people. So you have environmental, you have sustainability, you have people, you have a purpose to your profession. The purpose to this profession is about people. And either keeping them safe, or whatever you want to talk about, making businesses aware of the risk they're taking, what managing the risk to people, to individuals. Actually, that seems to me to be quite appealing generally. Mm. But then you get to this point where it's become a I think it moved to being more of a compliance function, or we have the right answers, you have the wrong answers. Mm. I certainly don't have the right answers. I can help people think things through and manage them, but I don't have all the right answers.
Yeah.
And I guess I'm similarly perplexed, because for me, what could be more interesting?
Yeah.
People are fascinating.
Yeah, exactly.
And what we're trying to do is ensure that we are managing the risk to people through what we do.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Some of the most fascinating, I mean, don't get me wrong, like, I probably changed my perspective on safety when I started doing this podcast, maybe a few months before, when I got the insight into this new world of behavioral-based safety and psychology and HOP and all this sort of stuff. And it's such a, I feel, Jesus Christ, no one's talking about the Health and Safety at Work Act. This is amazing.
I know. It felt liberating, didn't it? I was saying, so I remember, and it was an Irish conference in, I can't remember what year it was, about 7-8 years ago. Yeah. Kevin Furness spoke, who was there. Yeah. Just, but actually he said some stuff that just really impacted. And it was more about, at that point in time, it was about how you get people to pay attention to safety. The objective of the business is to be successful. Mm. It's safety isn't their first priority in nearly every case. Actually, it's to be successful, and safety is one of the things you manage within that framework. Mm. And it started me thinking, and then I got to see kind of other people speak, and John Green had a big impact. And because I think it enabled me to start thinking differently.
Mm.
And by thinking differently, I was then able to go, okay, hang on a minute. Why do we do all this stuff? Why am I writing this management system to make sure that every version, why don't we deliver this in a way that's better for our business? Mm. Why don't we think about our people and how they want us to talk to them, rather than talking to them the way I'm told everybody else does?
And then
the stuff we did with the psychology of risk in organizations is really interesting when you start looking at financial risk. If you look at, take the stuff that happened in the finance sector before the crash, look at all that happened with the traders, everything else, it's so akin to the thinking we have around safety. It's so, why do people make those decisions? Why do they choose to go after those goals that are seen as massively risky afterwards?
Yeah.
Just really, it's such an interesting area to be in.
Yeah, it is. On the Future Leaders Steering Group, you're trying to kind of communicate that out, in that, we want to be talking to young people that are potentially ready to join this career, but don't even know what this career is. And we were kind of talking about what level, what age group do we want to target? And I said, well, I'd like to target kids, like proper kids at a young age, and show them what risk and safety really is. I did a careers day at a local school, and they were like young, I think they were like 12, 13. We did this careers day. I think they're just going on to GCSEs at that age. I'm not sure. Anyway, and we were talking about safety, and these kids got it, man. They really got it. And they just absolutely nailed this stuff down. And I remember saying, you could tell, I knew what kind of kid this was. He was the you know, ballsy, kind of like loudmouth little bully kind of kid. Like, but I got on with him, which is ironic because when I was in school, I probably would have avoided some of that. But I got on with him, and when I was talking to him, I was like, what do you think about safety? And we were talking about it, and he said, oh, he gave me this example, and I use it all the time. He went, oh, me and my mum, we go and stay in this caravan sometimes, and it always makes me laugh when I go in this caravan and there's this sign saying, warning, slippery when wet. And I always go, and I remember he looked at the teacher and he went, no shit, like really quickly, because he wasn't allowed to swear. and the teacher just kind of raised his eyebrows a bit. And I was just like, but that's exactly it, isn't it? Like,
yeah.
you know that slippy, don't you? And he was like, yeah. And I was like, so why do I need to tell you? And he went, you don't. And I was like, exactly. And that's why we need more people like you to come into this industry and tell us, you know, hang on a minute, this doesn't work. These kids get it. So anyway, we're talking about targeted at that age, but that's a very difficult age for, I understand, a group like IOSH to get into and get into like lower education schools. So we're not really at that point yet, but you know, we are at the point where potentially we could talk to university students. And they said, well, what kind of students do you want? We just want to talk to people doing a health and safety degree. And I'm like, nah, I don't want to talk to them. They've already picked the career because they're doing a degree.
They've already selected in.
Yeah. I don't care about them people. I talk to them when they get a job and they'll help them, whatever. Yeah. Who I want to talk to is people doing engineering degrees, people doing psychology degrees, people doing sociology degrees, people doing biology, occupational health. Any number of these degrees that have an aspect in what we do, because our scope in a role is so wide that I know what you're thinking of doing and going into psychology, and maybe you're thinking of being a counselor, but if that doesn't work out for you, we could really do with some more people like you coming into our career. And this is what it looks like.
I do think the getting out there and talking, and I think secondary schools, do you know what, it won't be long before they're all working. And actually I think that bit about really increasing diversity as well is so important, and diversity of thought, diversity of background, you know, that's so important. And really you need time to make a big change for that, and that big change is going to come, I think, because people, you're going to spark an interest and people are going to go, wow, that's what you actually do every day. I never knew there were people like you. Like when I talk to people about what I do, they kind of can't believe those jobs even exist in the whole world. Because what you don't know, do you? You don't know all the, until you get into an organization, you'd have no idea of the jobs it takes to get things over the line.
Yeah.
And the jobs in the middle as well, completely random that you never thought of. So I think there's a big, I think, yes, you can persuade people doing other subjects, but I do think there's a big responsibility to actually just talk more with more people about what it is we do. Because we talk to each other about what we do, but we're not, and I'm not great at it. I've said I'll go and talk, like, my kids are quite good at talking about what I do because I get cool points for the companies I work for. I'm definitely the coolest parent for the companies I work for because we make TV. TV and TV. Content is still...
Yeah, true. When did somebody who's a health and safety professional get cool points from their kid? Wow.
Exactly. There you go. You see, I was like, oh, well, and that, there you go. It's the place to be.
I think you should just retire now, Ruth, because you can't get any better than that.
Cool point. I mean, yeah, they're 10 and 7. So when it gets to 15, I might be off the agenda as cool. Ooh,
yeah, that's a risky age. Cool's disappeared at that point. Yeah. Wow. There's one last thing I'd like to put to you. When you were talking about Netflix and that, what attracted you is that kind of culture piece. When I think about culture, there are so many podcasts, YouTube channels, vlogs, etc., that talk about culture now. You could look at, I can't remember what they're called. I think it's an animal. There's like a social media marketing company. The branding is all orange. I can't remember what they're called for the life of me. I think it's Giraffe. No, that's a restaurant. Anyway, that's not to the point. They do this vlog all the time and they talk about culture so much. And they talk about the stuff that I talk about in culture. But they're not safety professionals. They're marketing professionals and so on and so forth, right? Then you've got, there's another social media company. They run a podcast called Social Minds. I can't remember what they're called either. Their CEO's got a podcast called Diary of a CEO. Like, there's all these companies talking about culture. You've got Netflix setting up, you know, they've got their framework of culture and stuff like that. But like, I mean, what, safety mentioned culture for the first time after Aberfan, I think, which was what, I don't know, 60s, maybe before, I can't remember.
Mm-hmm.
So we've been talking about it for all this time. And for me, this is why I call this, this is why kind of we call this podcast Rebranded Safety, because we've been talking about this all the time. We kind of missed the boat. We people should be talking to us. We've been talking about culture since I've arrived. People should be coming to us and going, can you teach us about culture? But they're not. Because we've
and that's the point, really, isn't it? Back to the, we've kind of done a cycle of conversation, because you're back to the beginning, which is actually we've learned a lot and we know a lot, and yet we're still in this kind of place where, so I, the organisational culture is broader and bigger than the safety culture, which is one part of it, but it's, they're intrinsically linked. They're one and the same thing. The organisational culture becomes the safety culture and the risk culture. And that, and I think maybe the safety, maybe part of it was, and this is off the top of my head, so nobody bite my head off for saying this, maybe by making safety culture something different and standalone that you measured, it had less impact, because you started talking about just the safety culture rather than the organisational culture. And then it becomes in a box of its own, and this thing that is just about safety. Whereas all the safety, for me, everything that is safety culture is organisational culture. So all the important stuff that actually feeds an organisation that I want to work in is within the organisational culture, which then impacts the safety culture. And there's some nuances probably that make it more safety specific, but actually I can't think of any that don't roll up into the overall culture of the organisation.
Yeah. I use pizza to describe my analogy of culture, because, well, I just love pizza. But if you imagine you've ordered yourself a Domino's, right? And the Domino's turns, you've got yourself a nice large pizza, whatever you can, the type of pizza doesn't matter. I'm veggie, so I'm going to stick with good old margarita. So get your old margarita pizza, right? And the guy's gone through with his roller, yeah? And some slices are bigger than the other. Some slices are the little slices, some slices are the big slices. That whole pizza is the organizational culture.
Yeah.
Now, if you got that pizza and there was a slice missing, you'd be pissed off, aren't you? You're going to ring Domino's. You'd be like, I'm missing a slice, blah, blah, blah. Your delivery man's obviously had a bit of a nibble on the way here. It's not a full pizza. So you don't want that pizza. So when you kind of, I remember starting at a company and they had pretty good culture. From a large part of it, from an organizational point of view, there were some regional pockets, like little communities as you went around the national culture. So I think that's a slice of the picture, like regional cultures, like regional communities, that's a slice. And you've got safety culture, that's a slice. It slides into that organizational pie. And I think you have to pull sometimes, you know, work out what slices are cool, what slices are fine. How do we kind of keep those slices in a good condition? But what slices do we need to just pull out, focus on, work on, and slot back in?
See, I would have a different, my slices would be different than yours. Safety wouldn't be a slice. Ooh, okay. So I think, so if I take, one of the things I'm really interested in, and I'm interested to kind of a geeky level, is psychological safety.
Yeah.
So the ability to work and speak up, all that stuff that's really good. Now that is part good psychological safety is part of good organizational culture. That impacts safety, physical safety or mental health, whatever you like.
Yeah.
The slice is psychological safety. Safety is a part of that for me. There is a slice that is around, if you like, the way we communicate with each other, the way we talk to each other every day, the way we refer to people, maybe. Yeah. There's a slice that's around procedures. Are we a company that has loads and loads of procedures that you have to follow 1 to 100 steps to do to file an expenses claim? Or are we a company that says, you know what, we're quite free about this. You think it was worth spending? You can tell me why, that's fine. And all those slices make up your organizational culture. And safety is a little bit of every slice that then you pull together, rather than pulling safety culture out as a separate piece.
Yeah, I quite like that, actually.
And then you can have a big piece of pizza that's lots of different parts. That's your safety pizza. And then you'll have your whatever other part. Because did you think anyone's going to say, and they probably will now, this is probably a term, you have a data culture.
That's a very good way of putting it. Yeah. Oh, that's got my brain going.
There you go. Now I'm on the I need a pizza.
Wow. I didn't think of it like that. When you just said that data piece, that is mind blowing, actually. I've been using that example for years and you've just ruined it.
I'm so sorry.
End of podcast. Who invited this woman on?
Who goes off on little tangents? I always say to the people I work with a lot, and I get called a hurricane at times at work because I go in and have all these new ideas. So they go, Ruth, calm down. And I heard a saying on the radio ages ago. It was one of the governments that were in. They said they take their thoughts for a walk in public. I do that a lot. I take my thoughts for a walk in public. And then I go, okay, did I? And it's when you think, I'm very happy to discuss it. Don't hold me to account for this, but this is where my brain's going now. It might come back the other way, but that's where it's going now.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm a bit like that, to be fair. Like, my thoughts are very dynamic. Like, I start the conversation, and then by the end of that conversation, I've completely changed track of where I'm going. I think we should do this. Blah, 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 blah. I'm actually thinking about, maybe we should do it like this. And then by the end of the time, you're like, well, this is completely different to where we started, but it's better. We're in a better place. So that's good.
I've learned a lot about articulating a vision, which is quite important.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And I think we come back to that language piece is like, you know, how do you articulate your vision? So my vision is like, yeah, like you're saying, like good psychological safety, good culture that delivers, you know, a safe environment, safe production, whatever we want to call it. But what does that mean to the people I'm trying to communicate it out to? And what are their priorities?
How do I engage with them? How do they want to be talked to? All those things. We sat down a few years ago and talked about our values as a team. And we came up with empower, innovate, and collaborate. And they're the three things that as a team in the center of the business, we wanted to be known for, and we would be known for, and everything we did and we do, and they will carry on doing brilliantly because they're an incredible team.
Yeah.
Will be underpinned by those values. And what a great place to be, a team that's trying to deliver on that every day.
Empower, innovate, and what was the other one?
Collaborate.
I'm stealing that as well.
And one of the team worked out, if you do innovate, collaborate, empower, it spells ICE. And then you can use the little ice baby theme tune if you want to on your podcasts.
Oh, we're there. We are so there. That is happening. Do I have to put sponsored by ITV on it?
Yeah, definitely. I'll have left behind. But I do think, and actually that was a team, that's not me telling them, that's us working together, because actually that's the thing, you are a sum of your parts as a team in an organization, and it's an amazing place to be when you're all trying to achieve the same thing.
When you kind of, I will let you go in a bit, maybe I might not actually, it depends.
I have to go and cook lunch.
when you go to, like, you're talking about the kind of, you're really interested in the way that kind of Netflix talk about culture, and that, you know, it's quite positive. Like, what do you kind of, maybe you don't want to explain it in this sense, but like, I was gonna say, what do you expect to see? Feel free not to say that, because you might be like, shit, I don't want to say that, and then go to Netflix and it's not that. But like, the question I suppose is, what does a good culture actually look like?
I think it allows everybody, as part of this is allowing everybody to be themselves and bring their best self into whatever activities you're doing. So part of that is, for me, actually thinking about not having loads and loads of procedures for the sake of procedures. How do we enable people to do what they're trying to do and be part of the end goal? But also that, for me, the being able to, everybody's opinion be valid, everybody feel able to speak up and listen to, the farming for dissent, all those things that are so, so important that actually, but you need really ingrained, you need them to be so much more than just lip service. And I also love their constant feedback loop, the fact that is, and even what I'm, every dealing I've had with them, it's been so clear, it's not just a statement, it's part of the DNA of that organization, the culture.
Yeah.
And I just, it's going to be really interesting, because we'll wait and see. And
yeah.
I genuinely think that if anyone's interested, it is worth, and I've read their culture memo long before I saw this job advertised and long before I've joined.
Yeah.
But it set my brain thinking, because so much of it is similar to the stuff that those who want to look at how safety is done for the next tranche of safety, whatever you want to call it, actually so much of it is interlinked with all the changes in culture that everyone, big organizations are going through. They've become less hierarchical.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I like that. Okay. One last question. Best celebrity that you've met from working in the creative industry? Go.
Do you know what? Okay, I'm going to give you two, because one was at the National Theatre in my first job. So I was only at National Theatre for a year, and I walked into the postman and Alan Rickman was posting a letter, and he was talking to the person in the post room, and he had that voice that I've never been starstruck since. Oh. It was quite good that I was starstruck so early on, because I was like, oh my God. And the second one, I think, was, so I'm a bit of a Bon Jovi fan from many, many years ago. Mm-hmm. And they were on a show on ITV, and I got down, went down to the studio, because you've got to be seen on the floor sometimes, and got to see them rehearse just in front of them.
I'm just here to do a behavioural observation. Nothing to do with Bon Jovi.
do you know what's amazing is those moments you go, it is actually incredible. But watching shows be pulled together and what it takes to make the smallest and the biggest content, you would never believe it until you see, and the passion people have for it in the sector. Mm. The way they've come, honestly, the way they've navigated COVID, the creativity, the stuff they did to get cameras into people's homes, to get actors self-filming, because they have a passion for their what they're doing. It's something you do because you really believe in your art form, if you like, because you believe in what you're trying to create.
Yeah, I love it. I think, I don't know if it was on ITV or what, but Jamie Oliver did like a whole series off his phone or something like that.
The thing is, you never normally get that. Now everybody's getting a bit bored.
Yeah, and I'm just like, wow, that's amazing.
It is, and you saw that, and part of our role within that was to enable that creativity. So to give them the framework they can work within, so to go, okay, you need to think about this, this, and this. These are the things that we know we can't do. These are the things we think we could do. This is the space you can now think. Here's your sandpit. Go and play in it. We're going to build, the barriers are moving in because we've got COVID. So there are certain barriers at the edge of the sandpit we've moved in. Mm-hmm. Now you guys, because you're the people who do this every day, can work out creatively how to best deliver it. And I suppose that's the sharp end, blunt end piece of pulling them together, is we're building the sandpit that they then build their castles in.
Mm. And that comes back to that thoroughness and efficiency thing, isn't it? The thoroughness is at the top end, where you're deciding how big is the sandpit, what's our scope here. That's mm-hmm. the thoroughness. And then we go, right, here's the scope, we've defined it, here's what you must do, here's what you must not do, and then everything else, just get it done, off you go.
And how you communicate that sandpit, if you like, how you engage with people and make it seem an enabling thing, that you're helping them, that you're not saying you can't all the time. You're saying, okay, I'm trying to work out what we're able to do, and we're doing our best to find that out. And we did, one of the team said, chat this, we did loads of Q&A sessions with just people in the safety team, getting on a hangout and inviting as many people as wanted to come along from production. So lots and lots of people, to just say, this is what we know now. Anyone got any questions? Because you're just transparent and you're a person, you're not producing lots of documentation, you're talking to people.
Yeah, I love that.
Which, by the fact we've been on this call for ages, is probably my downfall.
Yeah.
Talking a lot.
Note to self, Ruth and James can talk a lot. Don't combine in one.
No.
Or book out entire day.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. On that note, Ruth, I am going to let you get back to your life and your children.
Thank you very much. I shall.
Is it Sunday today?
It is Sunday. Oh, I will get back to my Sunday. I will go and sort out some Sunday lunch, maybe.
There you go. Well, have a lovely day. Thank you very much, Ruth.
No problem. Lovely to speak to you, James.
Okay, peeps. Hope you enjoyed that conversation. Did I do my sponsor shout out? I don't think I did I? You got away with that one there, you lucky buggers. You lucky buggers. Before we say goodbye, a quick word from the sponsors. Our sponsor, Paradigm Human Performance, very grateful to them for sponsoring us. It helps us kind of work on our content, helps us get better content, improve our quality, and ultimately it helps us get an amazing company out there a little bit more into the eyes of our and ears of our audience. So if you're listening to this and you're in a small and medium-sized enterprise, or maybe you're listening to this because you are the owner of that small and medium-sized business, and you're thinking, oh, I'm listening to this because I need to get a bit better at safety, then Paradigm Human Performance's HSC subscription service is the solution for you. Starting from just £99 a month, they will make you compliant. But not only will they make you compliant, they will make you appreciate how to get the workers' subject matter expertise
into your brain and into your system, how to put worker safety, the DNA of what you do. And this is not just any old compliance system. This is a HOP system. So it's got HOP woven through it. So this isn't the kind of compliance system that you're going to have to declutter once you've read a couple of Decker's books or Honagel's books or so on. This is a ready to go option delivered by human organizational performance experts. Paradigm have got some amazing visions. Teresa is an amazing lady, the founder. She's involved in so much of what I do. I have so much time for her, so much respect for her. And when we got to the point where she was like, I'm thinking of sponsoring Rebrand and Safety, it was just such a good fit. They have such an amazing vision of educating people and opening people's minds and getting people in front of people. Basically, good people doing amazing work and getting them in front of people. And that brings me on nicely to their learning organization webinar. If you're not quite sure about the working with them yet, go check out the learning organization webinar. Website's in the description below. It is phenomenal. So good. Every Tuesday, 2 o'clock, I'll see you there on there most Thursdays. Okay, finally, just a note from Project Meletium. Project Meletium is a mastermind community for people that manage health, safety, risk, anything like that. It's the only mastermind community in the safety profession. It's the only place you're going to have regular philosophy conversations. It's the only place where you're going to feel psychologically safe to have an open and honest conversation, and a community that's there to genuinely help you grow and help you succeed. And in my opinion, it's one of the most diverse membership organizations we've got already, and it's only been going for 4 months. So if you're interested and you want to come check it out, you can come on our weekly community calls free of charge. We'll get you on one of those. Just talk to me or Colin Nottage, the co-founder, or email us both at me@projectmeletium.com. I'll put all the details in the description below. Once you join, you'll get to go on those weekly community calls. There's run on a Wednesday and a Friday. We also run a monthly philosophy call. Like I said, the only place that's having safety philosophical discussions. We'll also have a monthly book club and a quarterly Wagon Wheel Mastermind event where we have keynote speakers and workshops with that keynote speaker. We get close and intimate conversations with them. Okay, peeps, that's enough from me. I hope you enjoyed that conversation, and I'll see you next week. Safe.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the host and its guests and do not necessarily reflect the position of the companies. Examples of analysis discussed within this podcast are examples only based on limited and dated open source information and should not be utilised in real life as the only solution available. Assumptions made within this analysis are not reflective of the position of the companies. No part of this podcast may be reproduced, stored, or transmitted in any form or by any means, mechanical, electronic, or otherwise, without prior written permission from James McPherson.